Listeners, go to nationalreview.com/survey to fill out the National Review survey on podcast listening. Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. I have been thrilled all week with the incredible feedback we got from my discussion with Orrin Cass at American Compass. Many people critical of me, many people critical of Orrin, others neither critical or complimentary, but just, you know, in thoughtful engagement. I hope that I'm going to continue that process here today. The guest I have today is a bit more on this side of the issue than I am. It doesn't mean that I agree with every nook and cranny of the way he approaches it, but he does have the more traditional market view on trade, and one that Orrin has been more critical of. And it's the position that I generally come from, even though some of the arguments I may frame a little differently. But I do think that Scott Linsacombe at the Cato Institute has become one of the leading spokespeople in the country for advocacy of global free trade. And has a lot of information and perspective that help us avoid some of the straw man arguments and some of the characterizations that critics of trade will often engage in. And so I want to unpack some of these things with Scott, see what his perspective is today, and see if we can't continue advancing that subject as to what the right view may be. And when I say right view, I do not mean the right wing political view necessarily. But I mean, for those of us who have the same objective that I have stated I have with this podcast, which is a defense of an advocacy for and promotion of a free and virtuous society. And there's a lot of heat on the second part of that right now around whether or not global trade, first of all, whether or not it does bring about a freer and more prosperous society. I happen to think the record on that is much clearer. But there is some debate there. We're going to continue hashing that out. But then on the side of a more virtuous society, and I think Scott's going to bring some arguments to the table that might suggest the record on this is perhaps much more nuanced than critics of trade would want you to believe. So with that said, let me bring on Scott Linsacombe as today's guest on the Capitol Record. So with that said, allow me to welcome to Capitol Record for the very first time, Scott Linsacombe, one of my favorite public thought leaders on the subject of trade. Scott, welcome to Capitol Record.
Wow, thanks for having me.
So listeners to our podcast last week were treated to a lengthy discussion between myself and Orrin Cass regarding the impact of globalization to the market economy, particularly its impact on domestic actors, laborers, and a lot of the negatives associated with it. You've been leading the charge in favor of the more traditional, I think, Smithian, non-mercantilist view of trade for some time. I was first introduced to you by a lengthy piece you wrote in the print magazine of National Review during the 2016 election. You're a trade lawyer, you write on the subject at Cato Institute. But I guess I would ask you, Scott, just after 4 or 5 years of public debate on this subject and a lot of moving tides since President or then candidate Trump famously brought trade skepticism into the Republican platform, what do you think right now about the state of the argument? Are you moved at all by any of the positions that have swayed in the last 4 or 5 years about the negative impact of trade on the U.S. market economy?
I hate to be cliche, but I'd say no, not really. I think the last 5, 6 years have been quite the vindication for the realistic free trade side of things. You know, so often we free traders are painted as market fundamentalists in that the United States economy is this just bastion of open and global free trade. But, you know, the arguments, I think, are a lot more nuanced. The U.S. economy is a lot more complicated than that. But in general, if you look at the claims that were prominent in 2015 and 2016 about import competition, about tariffs, about trade deficits, about supply chains and the rest, and you can really go down the list and you can tick off the experiences we've had since that have, I think, really reinforced the idea that globalization and economic openness are, you know, to paraphrase Churchill, the worst option except for all the others, right? That there's going to be messy, imperfect occurrences. There's going to be disruptions and dislocations, which are inevitable in any market economy process. But the alternatives are just far worse. They not only impose immense costs, but they tend not to achieve the objectives they set out to achieve, and they foster all sorts of political dysfunction along the way. And, you know, of course, we can then get into all of that as we go. Now, I would add, though, however, I think that the one thing I maybe underestimated in the last few years is just how cemented the conventional wisdom is on trade politics, and that regardless of everything I've just said, regardless of changes in the Democratic Party to become much more suburbanite and educated and elite, there is still this belief that protectionism is a political winner out there, and that you know we have to be protectionist, we have to be confrontational and unilateralist with China. It's really the only course of action, regardless, again, of all the various failures of the last few years.
So do you think that free trade orthodoxy and market fundamentalism, these terms that get thrown out there, my view is pretty simple. When people are using it literally or to formulate an argument where there's not this intended pejorative context, I'm interested in unpacking it a bit, because I actually think sometimes it isn't necessarily accurate. But that when people are using it just to sort of substitute for a real argument, that it isn't very helpful. But I wonder, when the general principles of free trade, the general principles of comparative advantage, some of the things that are not particularly complicated yet, that when they go up against, I'm going to wait to go to the moral argument, the cultural argument, and some of the concerns people have, particularly about China. But right now, national security, okay, the our reliance on China, it's some part of the supply chain from a fab standpoint with semiconductors. Is there a concern that you have as a market fundamentalist, as a free trade advocate? Do you believe that U.S. trade policy, not with the politics, but with the actual policy and our varying objectives, which would include national security, has gone wrong here as it pertains to semiconductors?
No, I don't. You know, chips are a great example, I think, of how muddled the debate really is. So what you hear all the time is that the American semiconductor industry is destitute. It's really on its last leg. If we don't pump $52 billion of taxpayer funds into the industry, you know, China's going to take over and all of this. If you look at the facts, it's pretty different. Starting with the fact that the United States remains a tippy-top global leader in semiconductor innovation, R&D, design, all of that. Fabless companies like NVIDIA and Qualcomm are really the top dogs. Now, I'll get to manufacturing in a second, but that is critically important because simply the control of those designs, which have been, of course, facilitated by open trade, diversification. The companies can focus on R&D and focus on innovation and then let another company like Taiwan Semiconductor or Intel here in the United States focus on producing the chips. But that design control is actually extremely important in the semiconductor supply chain. And it is really at the tippy top of the scale in terms of the types of educated professionals that are working in those jobs, in terms of GDP and economic activity that generates, in terms of its benefits for the U.S. economy, all that jazz. So that's the first. But the second is that the U.S. manufacturing industry is doing okay itself. The United States, in terms of production, so output, not just dollar output, but actual physical output, the number of wafers we've produced, have increased substantially since the 1990s. Investment and capital expenditures outside of that fabless space have increased. You have Intel, of course, being kind of the national champion in that regard, in massive company with facilities here in the United States. But there are a lot of other fabs here, Samsung down in Texas. And you have companies, importantly, wanting to invest here. And they're investing here not because of subsidies or because of tariff protection or whatever. They're investing here because we have an educated workforce. We have other parts of the supply chain in terms of materials and equipment also located here or in Europe.
But why did it take this slowdown for Intel to now make this commitment in Ohio and Arizona, and it's going to have a couple-year lag? Why was that a 2021 decision instead of a 2015 decision?
Well, Intel made a bad bet on a couple of production technologies and had some setbacks in terms of just getting their top-end chips up and running. But the other thing that Intel did was Intel really never embraced what we call a foundry model for chips. I mentioned NVIDIA, for example. They focus on the design and then they outsource that to a company like TSMC or Global Foundries. These are just companies that take your designs and make chips. Well, Intel never embraced that foundry model, which turned out kind of in classic trade econ with comparative advantage and specialization to be a really dominant business model for chips. And because Intel never did that, Intel started lagging in terms of the business it got and the amount it could invest. But the other thing is that semiconductors are notoriously cyclical. They are boom and bust industries that you're going to see a lot of people rush in with a bunch of capital expenditures because prices are high. The next thing you know, prices collapse and you have this lag. And so one of the reasons why you didn't see a ton of CapEx, 5-10 years ago was simply because we were in the trough of the cycle. But that doesn't, again, mean that we needed to have subsidies, because subsidies, as you well know, can simply exacerbate those boom and bust cycles and lead to more financial harm for domestic companies and workers and the rest. So we're now on the upswing. There's pretty intense demand for chips, obviously, and everybody's investing. And again, they're investing here and abroad. Prior to the pandemic, about half of all chips designated for U.S. companies were manufactured in the United States. It was only at that tippy top bleeding edge end, so 5 nanometers, now 3 nanometers, where there wasn't U.S. production, and that was, again, because of Intel's struggles. But now, again, everybody seems to be wanting to invest back here. But I think the other really important thing on chips is to note China. So China is the great excuse for all of this industrial policy. But China has been trying to achieve semiconductor national greatness for 30 plus years. China has thrown tens of billions of dollars at the semiconductor industry, and it is still about a decade or so behind the bleeding edge companies like TSMC, Samsung, and Intel. Corruption and bankruptcy is common in the Chinese industry. And importantly, China is wholly dependent on foreign companies in Europe and in the United States for much of the semiconductor supply chain. In fact, the Chinese are desperately trying to repatriate or bring all of that onshore, and they're struggling to do so, even when they're trying to poach TSMC researchers and engineers from Taiwan. So China is a good example, I think, of the failed industrial policy model.
So do you believe that market forces are responsible for companies like Intel now seeing the errors they made, strategic decisions that didn't go their way? Now there is a interest in onshoring more manufacturing, and it seems to me that interest is not really driven by nationalism or protectionism, but primarily driven by market realities. Would your view be that it's better for the right thing to happen for the right reason than for the potentially right thing to happen for the clearly wrong reason, because of unintended consequences, because of cronyism, subsidies? What goes wrong when we try to get an Intel to do something outside of market forces and market logic?
So I think you hit the nail on the head there in the early part. And that, so one of the mistakes that I think a lot of protectionist folks, trade skeptics, industrial planners make is they assume, they take a snapshot in time, let's say 2015, and they assume that that is what's going to be the reality going forward. And what they miss is that supply chains and corporate decision-making are constantly adapting based on real-time information and facts on the ground. You know, it's a very Hayekian thing that you're having informational inputs from all these different sources. They're processing those and making different decisions. Now, over the last decade or so, companies have realized that, hey, and that's due to geopolitical tensions, increasing Chinese authoritarianism and economic nationalism. Of course, the pandemic, the global financial crisis is thrown in there too. So companies are changing their sourcing decisions, and they're doing that for all sorts of reasons. And so they're already doing what people like, aha, that's what we should have done. Now, the big challenge, however, is to predict the future. And that's where the industrial planning, I think, gets really into problems. Because while it's easy to look back and say, aha, mistakes were made, it is very difficult to predict what's going to happen next, particularly if you're not in the industry on the ground. If you're just sitting in Washington, D.C. or some think tank somewhere, you have a really hard time processing and predicting what's going to happen next. And so often when you look at industrial policy and protectionism, you see that the decisions that seemed like they made sense when you took that snapshot make no sense by the time that any sort of government plan gets put in place, by the time it's implemented down the road. So there's a huge knowledge problem issue. Sometimes, and like the case of semiconductors in the 1980s and 90s is a great example of that, we picked the right government planners, picked the right industries, but they picked the wrong product. So in the 80s and 90s, we all thought memory chips were going to be the big deal. So we subsidized and protected memory chips. We imposed tariffs and anti-dumping measures on from Japan and then South Korea. Well, it turned out everybody was moving from memory to logic chips, and we totally missed it. And there's these, I mean, it's almost hilarious documents from the Department of Defense and others about how this is essential to national security, these protecting these memory chips, and they totally missed what was happening in the industry. Meanwhile, contemporaneous reports from the industry players themselves were saying, yeah, we're actually already adjusting and moving on. So not only do you have the problem of knowledge and picking the right products and industries, but then, like you said, there's all sorts of unintended consequences. Going back to chips, for example, a lot of industry analysts think that given the amount of capital expenditures that have already been dedicated in the United States, we're talking like $80 billion in CapEx over the next few years, that government subsidies could essentially push us over the edge. So going from a decent supply-demand balance to one of overcapacity and glut. That would actually harm the industry long term. It also could produce trade conflicts as U.S. chip makers decide they need protection from chips made in Taiwan or elsewhere. So that will also increase costs. The last time we did that, we ended up pushing computer makers like Apple and Compaq was a company back then offshore because chip prices here were much more expensive than they were abroad. You also have the potential for other unintended consequences, like producing national champions in countries you're not even thinking about. So the last time we protected the U.S. industry against Japanese semiconductors, we ended up actually boosting Korean semiconductors because of the prices in the protected U.S. market.
Now, what do you think of the retort from the more protectionist camp that we're not worried about helping Mexico or Korea or Vietnam with an anti-China view because we're going further than just saying move from one country to the next? That's our whole point, David and Scott. Get it back to Ohio and you don't have to worry about Korea or Japan or Vietnam or China. And so that they would use you're making the point of the unintended global consequence. And they're saying if we keep this in a pure nationalistic context, we take that off the table.
Well, I mean, aside from the fact that you'd be likely substantially raising production costs and ultimate prices here in the United States.
Well, and if you weren't raising production costs, it would beg the question, why the hell people wouldn't be doing it on their own.
Well, yeah. Exactly. And let's face it, this gets to Biden's comment in the State of the Union about how we're going to ease inflationary pressures by imposing a bunch of Buy American rules, which, I mean, let's face it, if global supply chains were inefficient and costly, we wouldn't be using them in the first place. I mean, the whole point is to maximize efficiency and lower prices. But going back to your point, you know, trying to renationalize everything. Well, first of all, you're going to raise prices. But secondly, is you're going to be diverting capital, labor, and other resources from potentially more productive activities. You know, so for example, instead of people working in a job in information technology or something like that, maybe they're making t-shirts. Or instead of working in advanced manufacturing, they're doing some sort of low-skill manufacturing that has to be done here now because we've imposed all these tariff walls and whatever.
So your retort to their retort would just be comparative advantage, that they would be stripping away the law of comparative advantage.
In part, yeah, and specialization and letting capital flow to more productive uses. And this is, you know, classic kind of trade econ 101, right? That to the extent you force everything to be made domestically, you're poorer not merely because of higher prices, you're poorer because capital and other resources can't flow to its most productive ends in the United States.
And so this was the heart of Cass's argument with me, that he's willing to agree to that as a basic rule of comparative advantage in a kind of Smithian context, late 18th century, that part is good enough if you're talking about raw materials or natural resources, and that there is a genuine benefit for various countries to trade with each other what they don't have or can do more effectively. But that once you go from what he called their globalization 1.0 to 2.0, where it's no longer just natural resources and raw materials, but it's manufactured goods, you're adding labor to a material, that 2.0 becomes a bit more problematic in how one domiciles rules can be discriminating against another actor in your own domestic economy, namely the Ohio laborer not getting the work. But even then, there are ways in which that could be rectified. But that then globalization 3.0, where you're just flat out running a permanent trade deficit and making up the current account deficit with capital flows, that that part is inherently unhelpful and counterproductive to the American economy. And so I guess from where we are on talking about the benefits of cost, there is now an argument sort of asserting that that yes, that cost will go higher, but that that's a better price to pay than the price we're paying by running a perpetual trade deficit that we make up for with capital flows. By the end of the podcast, I shared with him the irony that when if I were to have this conversation with a Chinese nationalist economist, they would make the same argument that they're being unfairly treated by the right. trade deficit, because we get to settle the current account deficit as Americans in the world reserve currency that works against their best interest. But I guess his point was simply that capital flowing there was not doing anything for the American worker, them using it to finance our deficits and just basically pouring back into the welfare state. I believe his argument is not a critique of trade and not a critique of a trade deficit. It is a better argument against what our government does with the money and the way in which they finance their deficits. But I've thrown a bunch of stuff out there at once so we can reel it back. But I guess I'm wondering, how do you interact with those criticisms of globalization 2.0 and 3.0 that they go to a different place than the simplicity of 1.0 when we're talking about comparative advantage amongst nations?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think that comparative advantage changes at all, because there's mobile capital or we have trade in intermediate goods instead of trade in simply raw materials. I mean, let's start with the intermediate goods, because I think that's really, really important. About half of all stuff we import into the United States are capital goods and equipment that American manufacturers use to make other stuff. So if you care about manufacturing in the United States, and let's face it, the United States remains the world's second largest manufacturing nation, second only to China. On a per capita basis, we still blow the Chinese out of the water. But one of the reasons is because we have access to all of these global manufacturing inputs. So you take a company like BMW in South Carolina. Well, BMW imports certain parts, including probably some semiconductors, I'm sure. But that supports a lot of jobs here in the United States, and it supports the production of some pretty cool automobiles. And autos are, of course, one of the miraculous sectors here in the United States over the last 20 plus years. And they've done that with very low tariffs on autos. We have some tariffs on pickup trucks, but in terms of kind of the SUVs and everything else that we drive, tariff rates are very low. For NAFTA, they're zero, even on trucks. But that is global trade in intermediate goods produces the same benefits as trade in raw materials. But then let's stay with BMW and get to globalization 3.0. Well, BMW needed dollars from somewhere to invest in South Carolina, and they got those, and that's the flip side of the trade deficit, is foreign direct investment and purchases of U.S. debt. So that FDI has been shown repeatedly to not just boost the companies and workers that are receiving the investment, but to boost the communities surrounding that investment. So let's stick with BMW, Spartanburg, South Carolina, really awesome place, actually, if you've ever been. Spartanburg used to be this kind of dying textile town. Here came in all this foreign capital, again, the flip side of that trade deficit, not just BMW, but Michelin, a French company, several other multinational manufacturers showed up. And now Spartanburg also, and this we'll get to the last point, become a destination for services. But Spartanburg benefited tremendously from being part of the global supply chain and being that they're in globalization 2.0, and in a part with capital flows 3.0. But I think the other big thing that the trade skeptics miss is that the vast majority of Americans don't work in manufacturing. even if we had trade surpluses like Germany or Japan, even if we had active industrial policies like those countries, the long-term trend in manufacturing is fewer jobs due to productivity gains, globalization, and the rest.
Technology.
Technology, exactly. And so we, everybody who works in services, is essentially a full 100% net beneficiary of that global supply chain, all those global capital flows, and the rest, including in areas that directly service some of those capital flows, like real estate. You know, if you're a real estate broker or whatever, you're going to benefit from, again, that economic activity. And so, like you said, we can and should, especially, you know, if you're on the right or a libertarian like me, be concerned about the amount of debt that the United States is issuing, debt that, of course, foreign companies and foreign governments can purchase. But that's a critique of the U.S. fiscal policy, not anything of a critique of global trade policy.
And so is this a fair statement that in trade policy as it has been since China joined the WTO, your argument would be that there has been a net benefit to the American economy, probably an overwhelming one, and yet within that net benefit has been more felt by service workers, by communities like Spartanburg, but that there has been a net pain to some obsolete manufacturing jobs and communities like Middletown, Ohio.
I think that's right. I wouldn't go so far as to say an overwhelming benefit. I mean, you know, if you're talking in pure nominal terms, and I think that's what people tend to forget. Trade with China, our consumption of Chinese-made goods and services is still a pretty small percentage of our overall consumption. The San Francisco Fed did something a few years ago and found it was something like 3% of total consumption. We can, even if we up that to 5%, we're really not talking about, you know, I mean, there's 95% of consumption that's elsewhere. You know, China is a big trading partner with the United States, but is just one of many trading partners. By the last stats I saw, about 20% of all imports come from China. So 80% of all imports come from other places, including, you know, Mexico and Canada being really big ones, where there's also tons of cross-border capital flows, by the way. Europe, of course, is another massive U.S. trading partner. European multinationals dot the landscape. If you ever drive from, say, DC to Montgomery, Alabama, you'll see a ton of multinational manufacturers all through there. And then, of course, financial institutions in New York and other places as well. So trade with China, it did produce net benefits for the U.S. economy and for the vast majority of American workers. Studies show, for example, that the China shock, which we call the disproportionate impact on American workers in the industrial Midwest, mainly due to increased Chinese imports, was offset by gains in employment in U.S. exports and in gains in services. Oftentimes, those services were in the exact same manufacturing companies as where there were job losses. So you take a company like IBM, for example. IBM lost jobs in laptop manufacturing, gained jobs in laptop design or marketing or other types of IT services. IBM today is more of a global service provider than it is a manufacturer or computer maker. So that's I think, really important, and I agree with you. But I think the bigger point that people miss is that open trade and the disruptions that open trade inevitably cause, benefits and costs aside, are really the price we pay for benefiting from the system itself, a system of open markets and dynamic market economy. And if you can't just simply say, aha, we can flip this switch off, we can flip this switch on, and everything's great. The reality is that there will be disruption. Disruption will hurt for some people. It will benefit more people. And that is really the price we pay for living in a market economy and for, you know, enjoying what's, you know, I think by most objective measures, mass abundance, especially compared to ourselves 30 years ago or whatever. And that's, I think, the key for when we talk about trade. Trade is one part of a broader open free market system. It's an important part, but it's certainly not the only one. But you can't just flip off one lever and let all the other and think that all the other systems will work just fine.
So, Scott, you said that you consider yourself a libertarian, and I know that you're at the Cato Institute, but are you moved at all by the cultural or moral arguments that we have not brought Western democratic freedoms to China as much as they seem to have brought some of their cultural problems to us, and they cite the MBA issues and you know, some of these other dynamics, Hollywood, you know, is there a problem that you think is worth addressing in how China's entry into WTO and particularly the sheer volume of China as an exporter to the US has played out in terms of the broader cultural or moral concerns that go past the prior economic argument?
Yeah, I'm not really moved by much of that, quite frankly. And I think the reasons are a couple things. I mean, first, we need to understand that China's entry into the WTO was a fait accompli, whether the United States agreed or not. I wrote a big paper on this. People can Google it if they want. But the fact is that by the time China was, first of all, China's WTO accession took about 15 years. And the United States was the last holdout. And the United States, China was getting in. You're talking about a nation with over a billion people, nukes, and had an economy that was reforming in all sorts of ways. And it was those economic reforms, which were mostly market-based, that was generating a lot of the export competitiveness that China enjoyed in the 2000s. So China was getting into the WTO. China is a huge country that is going to have some economic heft if it did what it did, which was abandon communism. That comes with some what I downsides in terms of global corporations are going to want access to that market, and they're going to do what they think is necessary at that moment to gain access. But at the same time, it strikes me as really overblown that China is exporting its culture to, say, the United States. Because if you look at things like the NBA, if you look at a lot of these other instances, these aren't really happening here in the United States. They're really dealing with issues that are happening in China. They're dealing with national issues. Now, look, we Americans, liberals in the small L sense, don't like that. We wish it didn't happen. But it's really staying quite regional. China's influence, it's not like, you know, all
the more
of a sudden,
fair way for our critics to say it would be that we have not been as successful exporting our values.
Right.
But it is not exactly true that they have been successful at exporting their values.
Exactly. And there, I think there is a legitimate point to be made that when I was a young kid researcher at Cato, that was during the whole permanent normal trade relations debate. And the argument for economic liberalization leading to political liberalization, so the democratization of China, making China essentially Japan 2.0, was made, but it was not the primary argument. So the primary argument for letting China into the WTO was purely commercial and pragmatic. The United States saw the writing on the wall. The United States wanted to enjoy the benefits of China's WTO accession, meaning more market access, which the United States could not have if it hadn't agreed to grant permanent normal trade relations. That's a WTO rule. Europe and every other U.S. competitor had granted this long before we did. So it was a purely pragmatic decision. And then there were other issues like cooperation on foreign policy, North Korea in particular. Democratization was down the totem pole, but it was made. And it turned out to be wrong. But that, again, was not the main, that was not the primary reason for letting China into the WTO. It's unfortunate that it has failed. And I would say it's failed so far. I think, you know, the
what
story
would be,
has,
what would the
hasn't
critics like to see? Like, I quote in my new book, Milton Friedman, who prior to WTO, I suppose he may have said, I think he said this even before Nixon's famous trip, but it was right around that time period. But it was well before NAFTA, well before Reagan, well before Bill Clinton, well before what we would refer to as the era of globalization, where Milton said that political freedom, that economic freedom, rather, was a necessary but not sufficient condition. And so to me, it seems like an argument against something no one's saying. Because I have never, as a free marketeer, heard anyone say that economic liberalization, let alone on a global trade basis, would guarantee political, religious, or civic freedom. But it does seem to me that the cause of political, religious, and civic freedom, which I care about a great deal, including for the Chinese people, is at least helped a bit and not hurt by economic liberalization, even if it doesn't guarantee it and go the whole way. I just don't know what I'm missing on this. I really don't.
Oh, you're exactly right. And again, if you go and look back at, say, Clinton administration speeches, if you look at the papers that were written on this, including by folks at Cato, you'll see that democratization was an argument. And it was made mainly in the terms that you said, that economic liberalization made it more likely that China would become more liberal. But it certainly, you're right, that this was painted not as a guarantee, just as improving the chances. And at the same time, the speeches, the papers, and the rest all really emphasized the economic benefits and the lost economic opportunities that would arise if the United States did not agree to let China into the WTO. And I'd be remiss not to mention that the United States also negotiated a bunch of what we call WTO plus commitments from China. So, for example, we could impose special safeguards on Chinese imports for the first decade, I believe, of China's entry into the WTO. We use a special non-market economy methodology in anti-dumping cases, which result in astronomically high duties on all sorts of Chinese products. And so this goes back to the idea that we're hardly this bastion of unfettered trade, right? We have a 600 plus anti-dumping or countervailing duty measures in place right now.
Even before Trump.
Yeah, before Trump. This is all part of the system. I mean, this is the system that allows for this to happen. Now, you know, the United States and China disagree about some of these things. But the idea that it was just this rubber stamp to let the Chinese communists into the WTO and flood our markets, and but out of some naive hope that they were all going to become, you know, it was going to become this thriving liberal democracy, is just nonsense. It's just not supported by the historical record.
It's interesting because in my world, which I'm not a trade lawyer like you are, but working in finance, I've had to listen for almost 15 years now to how we had just Wild West financial markets, totally unregulated, and that is where the financial crisis came from. And those of us who work in Wall Street are a little perplexed by the idea of unregulated financial markets. It seems like there's a parallel to what you're describing with anti-dumping and trade.
And healthcare too. No, and you know, it's the same thing, right? I mean, honestly, if you look at most of the arguments of the interventionist left or right all start from that premise, that assumption.
The straw man.
Right. We're living in this terrible, disruptive world of unregulated laissez-faire, and it is pushed, foisted upon us by global elites to benefit only the rich at the rest of our expense. And then, you know, again, any expert in any of those fields, financial services, healthcare, trade, you start saying, but wait, that's not reality at all. But, you know, again, that's the rhetorical argument. As I've written, you know, if you look at the amount of effort the United States government has put into protecting, subsidizing, or otherwise supporting manufacturing and manufacturing jobs in the United States, I mean, it's downright laughable to claim this is laissez-faire anything. And at the end of the day, the big problem is that these interventions just don't work very well. They don't work very well in China either, by the way. You know, the Chinese have a couple successes here and there, but they have a lot of failures too. And it's just the as painful and as messy as free markets are, they tend to produce better outcomes in the long run than any of those other systems.
Do you think at the end of the day that a lot of this, even on a global scale, is broken window fallacy, that the very painful incidents of certain manufacturing towns, the economic deterioration that's taken place in some parts of the Rust Belt, those stories are, I think, from a human level, compelling and upsetting. But rather than focus on the greater good across the entirety of our country, that we are focusing on visible and limited externalities as opposed to the invisible and the greater. Is this just Bastiat 101?
It's a lot. And I think the other big thing is that they tend to... Well, you mentioned the national side, right? So I think the trade skeptics will acknowledge that the nation as a whole is better off, but they then go on. But these communities have faced this disruption that's unfair. But the thing they don't do is they don't look at parallel communities in other parts of the country. So I wrote a piece a few months ago for the Dispatch, looking at Youngstown, Ohio. So this is a classic steel town down in the dumps. Every president has visited there. And, you know, and I compared it to Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina. And the reason is that both of those economies were at about the same point in terms of economic output and population in the 1970s. Greenville, Spartanburg focused on textiles, an area industry that ended up getting hit really hard by globalization. Youngstown steel, same type of thing. Both those industries also received all sorts of federal protection. The difference is that Youngstown wanted to stay this homogenous single industry mill town steel town. They wanted to stay 1970s Youngstown. Greenville Spartanburg said, you know what, we need to adapt. We need to be open to foreign trade and investment. We need to be open to diversifying into services. And it's great because if you see the population charts, they diverge. They start almost the exact same population. And then they go in exactly the opposite directions over the next several decades. Now, it's odd to me, and I've written as much, that for all the focus we place on the Youngstowns of the world, we ignore the Spartanburgs, even though these towns were subject and faced the exact same types of economic pressures. That strikes me as one, it indicates the failures are far more local. They are either company specific, city specific, state policy specific. That's the first thing. But second, and really importantly, the disruptions can be overcome and they can produce towns that are actually stronger, healthier, better, more environmentally friendly, and on and on and on if they go through that sort of painful and necessary adjustment. And none of that is ever mentioned when we talk about our communities that are hurt.
Well, I think your work there has been phenomenal. And I think that there was a sort of political regionalization benefit to the Bannons and Trumps because, you know, first of all, and not only benefit, but a successful one. Like it won them the election because Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, these states that were, you know, making those regional cultural issues, played to their advantage, but I think that it was sincere in that regard. But it does seem that now the more intellectual approach is not to focus on Ohio per se. I'm speaking particularly like Orrin Cass, but even other kind of right-wing skeptics now of markets and trade and things, they're more describing a kind of generic worker, that the American worker is being discriminated against in favor of the Chinese worker. And this was an interesting part of my discussion with Orrin, where he laid out that the two parties in transaction, that neither one of them is the victim of the transaction, which is very different than what President Trump used to say. He used to say it was unfair to the American company that had worse trade terms. And I always said, well, then why are they trading? If the terms are unfair and it's a free transaction, you simply don't do it. If they're stealing your IP, don't give them your IP. If they have tariffs and you don't have tariffs, then don't do the trade. And none of it struck me as particularly insightful on my part. But what Orrin brought up was, no, the problem with the trade is not Party A and Party B trading. It's Party C, who is not able to get the job because his local situation has labor cost, has benefits, has regulatory rules for safety that make it more expensive to hire him. And with worsening conditions, the worker in China is able to get the job. And so there's a protectionist issue there, but he's more talking about the notion of free trade is fundamentally never free because of these differing cultural expectations. It's nothing you haven't heard before. And maybe the argument is just sort of a hardline libertarian reply, but I have a feeling you might have some more insights you think are worth sharing on that argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's a few things. So first is that, I'm going to agree with Orrin that I think some of our tax and regulatory and other policies unfairly hamstring American workers and American manufacturers.
Think he'd say that. I think he would say those protections and high wage requirements and benefits are good, but... Well,
I mean, I think we might agree on corporate taxes, but maybe not. But I mean, you know, I think you can go along and a laundry list of items that essentially raise production costs in the United States in ways that are to the detriment of American manufacturers. Now, of course, a big one there is trade policy. I mean, we impose 25% tariffs on steel, for God's sakes, right now. I mean, it's crazy. One of these core industrial inputs where we've made the price of steel in the United States hundreds of dollars more per ton than in Europe, for example. I mean, we don't even need to deal with China. So I would say that there are plenty of domestic policies we could implement to provide better, to make American manufacturers and American manufacturing workers more competitive. So that's one. Two, however, is this goes back to this stagnationist mindset that the American worker is this homogenous lump. He's male, he's white, he's 40 something, he's in manufacturing, and we need to protect him, right? That it totally ignores the changes and churn in the market, but also in the types of workers we have. We have a lot of female workers these days. We have a lot of services workers. We have a lot of workers that value remote work or gig work, or so there's no single worker in that very kind of frozen mindset that I think you hear from a lot of trade skeptics. But the other thing is that they lose track of the fact that a lot of manufacturing jobs today just aren't very well paying. They don't have very good benefits. I wrote a piece a little while ago about Amazon in Alabama. It now pays more to ship t-shirts in Alabama than it does to make t-shirts in Alabama. So in other words, it pays more to be in transportation and warehousing than it does in manufacturing in Alabama. That's just a nature of the market process. And planners and protectionists just don't think about how much trade, globalization, goods and fairly trade or freely traded goods and services can support all these types of jobs that are good paying. Construction is, of course, another industry. Skilled trades pay great. Trust me, I just had to fix an appliance a little while ago. They pay really well. And on and on and on. And these things are all supported by open trade. When you put tariffs on lumber or tariffs on steel nails, you're going to decrease the number of construction jobs that you have. And I think people lose sight of that. One more thing before we go on. But we talk about morality a lot. And I think it's really essential to note that protectionism is, at the end of the day, taxing your neighbors to benefit yourself, right? That there's, I think, an inherent immorality in petitioning the government to interfere in a voluntary transaction between two individuals that just so happens to occur across a border. If I want to purchase, let's say you have a gas station in a neighborhood, two gas stations, one on each corner. The one gas station owner with higher gas prices or whatever doesn't have a moral right to my business. He doesn't have a moral right to petition the government to put the other gas station out of business or to impose a tax so that I can't purchase there. And by contrast, I have a right to engage in voluntary transactions as I see fit. And when others want to use government force to interfere in that, to line their own pockets, that's where I think the immorality lies. And I don't think the government should be tilting the scales in favor of one person, but that third party, regardless of their identity.
I used to make the case that there was a beneficiary with global trade who was the American consumer benefiting from lower prices brought about by lower production costs. And there was another beneficiary who was the foreign producer who was now getting the business and then exporting products. But I would grant the arguer that the domestic producer may be not necessarily the winner. But what you've done is point out that in all the complexity of global trade, the reality is that there is so many activities of manufacturing that take place in the supply chain, and that there is various goods that come in and get finished, or vice versa, that go out to get finished. But either way, there's American hands touching it, either coming or going. That really, even that is not is too simplistic. That the there is not as much of a forgotten man in this as we may think there is.
Oh no, and in fact, the other thing I would add is that the other invisible aspect of all of this is the money that consumer saves on buying a widget from abroad isn't set on fire. It's not buried in their backyards. It's either spent on other jobs in totally unrelated areas, services or whatever, or it's invested into a company, or it's put away for their child's education. So investment in their child's human capital. These are all invisible transactions that occur solely because the government didn't force that consumer to spend more on a domestic made product. And we ignore all of that, not to mention, of course, all of the dynamism and churn that simply a market economy produces. And, you know, there's innovation and productivity gains that go along with that. We miss all of that. Instead, we focus on just that lost sale for a certain American manufacturer and worker.
Do you think that as long as one operates from an intellectual basis, intellectual foundation of pitting capital versus labor, that all the things you've said today and that I would say and that these arguments fall on deaf ears, because disproportionately these benefits come higher to capital than to labor. And therefore that what I consider to be false dilemma will still leave those earnest advocates of a free society that are being led astray by what they consider to be disproportionate blessings from trade towards capital and labor leads them to have this highly pejorative description of private equity, of Wall Street, of shareholders, things like that. Is a lot of this just a fundamental error in pitting capital versus labor?
There's a big part, yes. I wrote a piece on sugar, on the sugar program a few weeks ago. So on the Kellogg strike. And so here you had a situation where Kellogg's workers were on strike. And of course, Bernie Sanders and others were furious that Kellogg's might be importing cereal during the strike or hiring scabs and the rest. And a guy like me looks at that and goes, well, the problem is that Kellogg's actually has to spend twice as much on sugar as its competitors overseas. And the money, and that's because of U.S. sugar protectionism, which guys like Marco Rubio say is a national security issue, but we'll leave that aside. And if I, when digging into the numbers, I showed in my column that a company like Kellogg's, so U.S. cereal makers, were spending about half as much on sugar as they were on labor total. So if you cut their sugar bill, that gives them the ability to spend more on wages. And there's research showing that companies make that type of decision. So this, I think, is a good example of how this capital versus labor adversarial relationship is not necessarily the case. Now, I have no illusions that Kellogg CEOs are going to suddenly take every single penny they save on sugar liberalization and put it into wages. But if you look at the data, if you look at the general trends, some of it certainly is. And that's, I think, how it's a much, much more complicated interaction between the two, capital and labor, and a much more complicated system in general. Because, of course, everybody is a consumer. That's the other thing, right? Even that American manufacturing worker in Youngstown who lost his job, he's still a consumer. So he still benefits in part from the system. Going into China trade, you're looking at thousands of dollars in consumer benefits for American families. So we all benefit from that too, but there's also much, much more complicated benefits that are kind of all intertwined in those market forces.
Well, Scott, I've kept you for the full hour here, and so I'll let you get back to your day job, but I think you really covered all the major issues here. I think we're engaged in a need to continue defending something that it requires more thoughtful defense, and I appreciate your contribution to doing so. The you've alluded to a couple of the things you've written today. I hope listeners will check some of that out. His stuff is fantastic. He writes and podcasts over at The Dispatch. And I got to say that it's been helpful to have you on this side here over the last 5 years, because a lot of things that I took for granted on my side of the aisle politically, I can no longer take for granted.
I hear you. I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
All right, Scott. Thanks so much. Well, I didn't keep Scott on as long as I kept Orrin on, but I think you got the gist of where Scott's coming from. I want to make a couple concluding comments. I think he does an outstanding job bringing us back to the basics, reminding us of some of the laws of economics that are just not able to be discounted, that cannot and should not be discounted when we talk about economic dynamism. That the fact of the matter is not just the comparative advantage that exists in globalization 1.0, 2.0, but when you look to the full orbed reality of what's taking place, the ways in which American workers, American service industries are touching things, benefiting from things, they get exported, they get imported, that in the complexity of the economy, the ability to drive for lower production cost, to create more goods and services at more competitive prices, and create more wealth for a greater number of people, that objective is hindered when we invite protectionist interventions. There are cultural considerations, there are national security considerations, and even those, when scrutinized a bit more, I think continue to push us back to a place of aspiring for a freer economy versus a more industrial rules-based economy. That said, this isn't the final word. We're going to continue talking to others on all sides of this issue, but hopefully doing so where we can let some of the rhetoric and some of the heat and some of the pejorative terminology that is a substitute for real argument go, and instead focus on really breaking it down to what is actually taking place and what our final aspiration may be. And I hope you've benefited from this conversation with Scott, from his great insights and wisdom and experience, bringing some more holistic facts on the ground to the discussion. And I hope you continue to benefit from listening to the Capitol Record. Each and every week, we want to bring thoughtful dialogue to the table in defense of the cause of a free society. Thank you for listening to Capitol Record. Please subscribe, review us, rate us, tweet us, socialize us, do whatever will help spread the word. Thank you for listening to the Capitol Record.